From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. The Smithfield plant is working to reopen according to guidance from the CDC. Investigators from the CDC visited the closed plant in mid-April and issued a report with guidance for worker safety and contagion control. President Donald Trump issued an executive order on April 28th calling for operations at America's meat production facilities to continue, quote, uninterrupted to the maximum extent possible, while following the CDC and OSHA guidelines. Joining us for a conversation about how workers are navigating the reopening of the plant, on Thursday we welcomed Cooper Caraway. He is Sioux Falls AFL-CIO president. Enjoy.
Cooper, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Lori.
I want to start from the last time that we talked. The plant was closed when you came on the program before, and we were waiting for the report from the CDC from their investigation. We've seen that report now, but we haven't talked about it. Tell me a little bit about some of the limitations of what the CDC investigators were able to tell based on the fact that they did not have access to workers in the plant.
Well, so there's two issues of the CDC report. Number one, obviously, all the recommendations the CDC made, we support, and the workers in general, for the most part, support. You know, it's a 15-page report, and 12, 13 of those pages are all things that Smithfield needs to be doing differently. And we can get behind that. But obviously, the two main issues with the CDC report are that, number one, it's not a particularly enforceable document. The CDC can't enforce it itself. You know, the state government would have to come in and say, "Hey, we're gonna enforce the document. We're gonna make sure that Smithfield abides by every single one of these recommendations." And they haven't done that. And number two, the CDC document makes it very clear that it's an incomplete document. It's an incomplete document because Smithfield upper management did not cooperate fully with the CDC investigation. They did not provide the CDC with significant data that the CDC requested, particularly demographic data and production model data. They're two pieces of data that are very important in order to come up with a good recommendation. The CDC has said that they would take the data, they would still accept the data even today if Smithfield wanted to send it over, and then they would update their recommendations. So those are two things that really need to happen. Someone needs to step in and say that they're going to be in charge of enforcing the CDC recommendations, and Smithfield needs to commit to cooperating fully with the CDC.
Is that responsibility fall on the state, on the CDC, or on Smithfield executive leadership?
Well, the state...
The enforceability feature, yeah.
The state could step in and say that using the state health department and say that, you know, we're going to oversee the implementation of these CDC recommendations. And if you don't follow all of these CDC recommendations on a given timeline, there's going to be penalties.
Let's talk about the president's executive order and how that changes the conversation.
Yeah. So I thought it was pretty poetic, that the, president issued this executive order on April 28th, the anniversary of the execution of Benito Mussolini. He's going to issue this executive order using his executive and state authority to send workers into unsafe conditions in order to secure short-term profits. And what are really going to end up being short-term profits? If any of these plants are opening prior to when it's safe for them to open, they're going to eventually have to close down in the next few weeks. And it makes more sense from a production standpoint to get things right now, to take your time and make sure the plants are safe so that you don't have to continue closing down in the future. But this is just a hasty move and a move done not with the working class people, not with regular folks in mind. It's done with corporate CEOs and profits in mind.
So this is based on the 1950 Defense Production Act, which maybe none of us fully understand the legal and the authority of that act, but we've heard an awful lot about it. And, you know, it says in the executive order, uninterrupted to the maximum extent possible while following CDC and OSHA guidelines. Are there legal ramifications to, there's argument about whether or not the president has the authority to use the Defense Production Act to send workers back to work, or is it simply to make sure that the products are manufactured or, you know, given to, you know, to the right people first? For example, if you're manufacturing masks, they have to go to America versus being sent overseas, and the president can order that. That would be one sort of example. Does the Defense Production Act really apply here? Are we just saying that the president has called everybody back to work? Has he really? Does he have the legal right to do that under this provision of this section of the act?
Well, that's what he's ordered now. Whether it's legal or not, I don't know. You know, and with this president, whether something's actually legal or not depends on who's willing to challenge the legality of it. And I don't imagine that the Republican-controlled Senate is interested in challenging the president on this issue. It seems to me like most politicians, Republican politicians, and their donors are behind the president on this. So I don't think there's going to be a difficult challenge. Another issue with the executive order is that it seeks to limit the liability of these companies. So basically, it limits the ability for workers to be able to sue their employers for putting them into unsafe conditions and then contracting this virus. And so that particular provision, you know, let alone that the Defense Production Act has been used for good things and in negative ways since it was created. But that set aside, adding in a liability shield for the most part with these employers really shows the true intent and heart of the executive order. It's to secure profits on the backs and at the expense of worker safety.
What do you know about the changes that have been made inside the plan? I want to talk about testing workers and going back to work in a moment, but first, there was a long list in that 15-page report from the CDC. Some of those changes were very simple, and some of them were very challenging because of the age of the plant and the way it is, the architecture of it when it comes to crowding. What do you know about what has changed?
That's right. Some of these suggestions are going to be difficult to implement. To this point, though, the folks on the ground in the plant have done a good job at starting to implement some of the easier things. They're going to continue with some of the things that they started before the plant shut down: temperature checks, spacing out in the for lunch periods. Things like that. Some of the simpler things are going to continue. And they're also going to continue when it comes to reopening the plant. They're going to be doing a gradual reopen. So this week they only opened two departments, and that's a couple hundred workers. And they're going to reopen the plant based on a gradual reopen schedule. And that's good. If they have to reopen, opening on a gradual reopen schedule is a good thing. I wish the federal government, though, would have given Smithfield and the workers time to implement all the CDC recommendations before the plant reopened. Unfortunately, that's not the position we're in.
There's a lot of pressure from, hog producers, from consumers, various pressures are being put on to really ramp up production. But the CDC guidelines specifically said one of the things that could be used to help slow the spread and spread workers out was to slow down the line, essentially, and have fewer workers there, or fewer shifts or spread out shifts or different innovative ways to look at the production line. What do you know about, is it going to be once, it's a gradual reopening, but is it going to be all hands on deck, all systems go, meet those quotas that we, or meet that production schedule that we had before, or is it a slower on-ramping?
I believe as soon as the plant has the ability to be fully operational, it's going to be fully operational, and it's very likely that these lines are going to be moving faster than they were before they shut down. The CEOs have done a good job at creating a narrative of scarcity and of a need to get things out on the shelves very rapidly and quickly. And so I think that once they have the ability to, the lines are going to be, you know, running faster probably than they were before the plant shut down.
Is it one or the other? Because it seems like in much of that, as you mentioned, the narrative that there is this balancing of, you know, clearly these are essential workers. You know, America needs, you know, protein on the table. Farmers need something to do with this, you know, with their hogs, which need to go to market, need to go to slaughter, and workers need to be safe. Is there a way for all those things to happen, for all those needs to be met, or are we really balancing people's health and safety against the food security of a supply chain?
There's certainly a way where everyone's needs can be met, but that requires foresight. And that requires proper planning. So it requires proper planning from the CEOs. Folks at the top of management need to, if you're running any company, honestly, but if you're running a very large and important company, what you need to be doing is having a plan or preparations in place for a situation in which you might need to shut a plant down for a week. Or 2 weeks. And it's become very clear that none of these large food processors, none of these large food production companies have had any plan for, you know, if they had to shut their plants down for a week or 2 weeks, because they were in complete panic mode when this stuff happens. With prior planning, you can develop ways to where you can maintain supply and productivity and be able to shut down for 2 weeks if your workers need it, in order to secure their safety. On the other hand, you need it requires proper planning and foresight from the government to look at and say, okay, if there's an emergency and some food production plants shut down, we need alternatives for these farmers to be able to bring their stock somewhere, whether that's the state and federal government teaming up to buy the hogs from the farmers and give them out to food and handle the processing themselves, give them out to food banks, whatever there is, or if there's a need to kind of break up these large production facilities so that everyone in an area or in a geographic area is not relying on one plant, where if you have many several different plants, some maybe smaller plants, maybe that would be more effective. But, you know, it requires bold leadership and foresight, both from the business perspective and the government perspective. And when this pandemic hit, at least, it's very clear we didn't have either one of those.
I am no expert on the Defense Production Act, and I'm not asking you to be one either. But as I sort of interpret it, the president could order whatever is produced at that plant to be sent to American stores and used to feed Americans. Clearly, there has been a huge export in the past, including to China. Do you know anything about, as that supply chain gets moving, where those products will go? Will they go to the proverbial us, or will they go overseas?
I don't think the president has put in a provision of his executive order that mandates that Americans be fed first. And I would be surprised if he had. I think that I don't imagine that this authorization of the Defense Production Act in this situation, I don't think this is a get it to the Americans first situation. I think this is from the standpoint of this executive order, I think this is let's get these companies back up and running and profitable again.
What do we anticipate from this testing site where so many people, thousands of Smithfield employees and their families are being tested in Sioux Falls? The Governor Noem said, expect these positive or confirmed cases to rise. What are the workers saying about the testing, about returning to work, and about what happens when some of those numbers come back? Because we know so well that this disease can be transmitted and so many people can be asymptomatic. So talk for a minute, if you will, about the workers and what they're saying about the testing and about the process to go back to work.
Yeah, so this mass testing is a great idea, and it's something that the workers themselves were pushing for a long time, since before the plant shut down. The workers were pushing for mass testing of every employee. For a long time, the state and the governor's office was saying that only folks who were symptomatic were going to be tested, and that caused a lot of anxiety and a lot of concern from the part of the workers, because they know that you know, many folks, maybe even a half or a majority of folks who contract the virus and somehow remain asymptomatic throughout. And that causes a lot of anxiety on a worker to know that you have been exposed in a workplace and around people who have tested positive. I'm feeling fine. I'm not showing any symptoms. But in the back of your head all day long, it's kind of eating at you that you know this whole time you might be carrying this virus to your coworkers. You might be carrying it back home to your family. You might be carrying it, you know, around your community and whatnot. And that causes a lot of anxiety. So this testing gives the workers the opportunity to kind of relieve that anxiety, relieve that stress, and know for sure, you know, and know for sure how to act responsibly from there. Not only are all the workers able to get tested, but all their family members as well. Their immediate family members are also getting tested for free at that same site. And so that's definitely a step in the right direction. Workers are still anxious. Workers are still a little nervous about going back to work. They love what they do. They love their job. They love their coworkers. They want to get back into their normal routines like everyone else does. But they really don't want to be forced to go back into the same unsafe environment that they left. When they go back to work, they want to be walking into a totally new environment, an environment that prioritizes safety. And we're doing everything we can to make sure they do.
Before I let you go, there are so many workers, the national spotlight in the South Dakota spotlight, obviously on Smithfield workers. So many other workers are inspired by this and anxious about how this is unfolded as they are asked to come back to work. What is your advice about workers in all kinds of industries, from restaurants to factories to offices, who are looking around and having conversations with management about safety that they really have never had to have before?
Yeah, the best advice I can give anyone, especially a South Dakota worker, if they have concerns about their workplace, if they have concerns about workplace safety or their benefits. A lot of workers are facing hardship now because they didn't have paid sick leave. They didn't have paid family leave. A lot of workers across South Dakota do not have either one of those things because that's something that's not guaranteed to South Dakotans by state law. A lot of states, they guarantee their citizens paid sick leave, paid family leave. But here in South Dakota, that's not something that's guaranteed to you by law. And a lot of workers don't have it. So my advice is, you know, the best advice I can give is if you have concerns like that, if you don't have these basic level protections, if you're concerned about the safety of your workplace, the best thing you can do is call a union. The only way that the workers in South Dakota have the authority and ability to get paid family leave and paid sick leave and better and safer working conditions outside of passing a law at the legislature, which is very difficult, is to organize a union, which is a comparably very simple process. And at that point, the management is mandated by law, has to by law, sit down and negotiate with you and your coworkers, safer working conditions, paid sick leave, paid family leave, these benefits that you're missing out on. So the best advice I have to South Dakota workers who are facing that anxiety and concern is to call a union.
Governor Kristi Noem has bristled at some of the reporting on her. Veteran reporter Kevin Wooster joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh to discuss these issues and more.
Kevin, thanks for being here. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's always good to be back, especially talking about journalism.
Right. And how long have you been, for perspective, for people who are listening, how long have you been in this business?
I wrote my first byline news story for the Chamberlain Register in 1973. So it's been a while.
it's been a few years. Been a few minutes.
Told that to the woman in one of the women in question here, Maggie Seidel, and she paused, as often do, and kind of did the math and said, wow, it's pretty good he's still coherent, or at least as coherent as we want to be.
Is that what she said, but, or is that what you think she was thinking?
That's kind of what I think she was thinking. She didn't say it.
We've just begun, and we're already putting words into her mouth.
That
all right,
my
so
assumption. Exactly. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about what has been happening largely on social media for people who are not journalists or maybe have just dipped into this story a little bit, because there have been some back and forths. And where do you want to begin with telling the story, for especially for those who are not aware of what we're talking about right now already?
Well, I think I'd begin with saying what I said on one social media platform. I can't remember which one it was recently. Was, boy, am I lucky that they didn't have Twitter when I was, you know, younger and maybe a little more aggressive and maybe a little bit more volatile than I am today, which is, I mean, hard for some to believe. But because I got in enough trouble with just newsroom, what essentially was newsroom email back in the day, you know, when you couldn't have an immediate public platform, which is can be, as Donald Trump proves every day, a dangerous thing. And I think I would have managed ways to get in trouble. And, you know, I watch some of the tweets that are sent out, and my understanding is reporters these days, you know, I think it's wonderful. Some of them have this amazing gift to sit at a meeting and tweet, 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 and essentially write a story while they're tweeting. And I don't think I could do that, that immediate type of stuff. And they manage to keep track of everything. But then sometimes they have these opinion tweets or these frustration tweets or these other kinds of tweets. And I see those and I go, ooh, really? And I've made a couple of comments. Jonathan Ellis and I had a comment about Maggie Seidel, the governor's senior press, senior advisor, and about something he said about her in a social media thing, and I mentioned it. And there was a little bite back from some people like, you know, hey, old guy, go fishing, you know, or either get off the pond or come back and help us do the job. Jonathan kind of implied that, and I didn't blame him for that. That was legitimate. And, you know, things were a little bristly between them and between different people covering the governor right now. It's a difficult time. And then we had this kind of exchange where Maggie Seidel was unhappy with a particular story and pointed that out to in an email to a group of reporters. I was one of them in the group. And an old Rep City Journal podmate of mine, Jeremy Fugelberg, who now works for Forum Communications in Sioux Falls, kind of fired back on a tweet. And I sent out a tweet saying, maybe do that more privately. Because that's the way we would always do it, I think, prior to all this social media stuff. And that kind of began a discussion that that culminated with Fugelberg and me having a conversation as I was out wandering around the countryside yesterday on cell phone. So the whole idea of how do you respond, what's going on with the governor right now in terms of this difficult time and also her future, you know, and her spotlight from the conservative media, I think, is a big part of all this.
It's a big part of what's driving this. This is not the first time Governor Noem has taken, has mentioned her frustration with the press. There was a press conference weeks ago where Bob Mercer asked her a question, and not sure I remember right now whose piece she was referring to, but I believe it was an Argus Leader piece where she sort of said, you know, some of the reporting is irresponsible, and you're trying to write headlines that grab attention. And so my point is, this is not the first time she has said publicly. So these reporters would say, if she can say publicly at a press conference that the press corps is irresponsible and take a whole group of people to task for one thing that she didn't like, why can't we say, hey, this is how the governor's office is responding to us? What would your response be to that argument?
I think that's a legitimate argument. We had that discussion. Just because the way we used to handle it was the way we used to handle it doesn't mean that's the way we should handle it today. I would have it out with Maggie myself. If I didn't like something that she wrote, I would, and I did. I sent her a personal email that was critical of the group email she sent out and talked about why I thought that was an error on her part, and, you know, very unwise. And then she asked if we could talk by phone the next day, and we did. We had an extended conversation, and I expressed myself again that I thought it was a mistake the way she handled that and why. That's the way we always handled it before. And to take it on to a social media platform, I don't know, it wasn't the way I would have done it. And I think sometimes it's almost us saying, look at what they're doing, look at what they're doing, or tattletale. But another person said, listen, we need to understand how they're operating. And showing that, sending that out, gives an insight into the governor's office and the governor's staff and what they're doing right now. And I think that's a valid argument, too. To me, I think they're both valid. I think you can make an argument for either one. But the question I always have is, does this do anything to improve your working relationship with the governor's senior staffers? Are you interested in improving that?
Yeah. And is that the goal? Yeah. I mean, because I think that's a big question. What is the goal here? Yeah. Is the goal to improve, or do you have a different goal in mind? And should you have? should your goal be? And what should the goal of the governor's office be as well at this point in her relationship with the media? And I want to bring us back to, as I asked that question, to Fox News and to national platforms, who South Dakotans tune into all the time. So you can't say that Fox News is for somebody other than South Dakotans, but those questions are not being asked by South Dakota journalists. So what is the discomfort that local journalists have with the amount of time the governor spends on national platforms?
I understand the discomfort. First of all, you have to say, wow, she has a news conference every day, virtually, or almost every day during the week. That's a lot. That's a lot of open access for South Dakota reporters who can call in or be there in person. And I know I would want more. I'm sure they want more. And then when you see her splashing all over the conservative media, you can't get a call back on some specific questions you have. I understand your frustration. I understand why but on the other hand, in a state where 62% of the people in 2016 voted for Donald Trump and Fox News is Trump's network, you're reaching a lot of South Dakotans when you're on Fox News or on those different kinds of programs. So I don't think you can deny that. You can't deny that there's a benefit to South Dakota from her being connected to Donald Trump and his administration. Whether you think that's always an admirable benefit or the benefit that's good for most South Dakotans is a debatable point. So it's a complicated question. And then we throw in this thing, well, she's just doing it because she wants to be a cabinet member or the vice presidential candidate, or she wants to run for president someday. And that's possible, too. And she brings in Maggie Seidel and Ian Fury and these with mostly Washington connections. And then people say that's all part of this setup to take her to D.C., and it may be just the fact that she's having trouble hiring locally because she's had some trouble keeping staff for whatever reason and gone through a few staffers. So there's a lot going on right now in a relationship that is bristly, but it's not unusual. I think Jonathan Ellis said yesterday, it's not all that usual to have a bristly relationship with a governor's staffer from time to time.
Right. Especially during a time of tension so much. I want to get, before we run out of time here, to this idea that Maggie did say in her email, which is, you know, you're not looking at the positives of what have happened here. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the administration's positives as we sort of see them right now, and then some of their missteps. What do you think they've done particularly well? What has Governor Noem done particularly well in handling the coronavirus in the state?
Well, I think she's been a steady hand. I think she's, and I know some people will dispute that, but I think she gives a consistent message of distancing, sheltering where you need to, and reducing the curve. And other than a blow up in Sioux Falls, I think things aren't going too bad in South Dakota. I think I said in a column recently, so far so good. I will it blow up? Will she wish she had closed the state down more? Maybe, or maybe not. We'll see. I have concerns about the coming tourism season. What's going to happen next. But I think there's been, and I think generally she's been open. I think if I would have one criticism for her and her staff, it's don't react so much. I mean, just focus on what you have to do and stop trying to somehow control news flow, because you can't. You can't. And also, I understand the charm of being on national conservative media, and when you can use that for our benefit as a state, do it. But we're the ones, the local media, that really count in this, in a time when South Dakotans are sick and in some cases dying. We're the ones that care about it. Fox News doesn't. They say they do, but they don't. We do. Remember that.
Has the administration been transparent enough? Because from the beginning with the epidemiological models, there was some frustration with what they were willing to release and how they were willing to release it. That has been a big frustration of journalists. Do you think that's a fair assessment of something they could have done better?
I think they sometimes push back more than they had to. Sometimes I'm a little too soft. I'm a little too trusting, and I'm assuming that if the models come out of Avera, Sanford, and Monument, and they go through the state epidemiologist and Kim and the health department, that there's probably pretty valid stuff being looked at. That doesn't mean it's perfect. But I understand why people are pushing for more answers. Sometimes we tend to push just to push when maybe we have enough. But that's part of the job. And I think sometimes they resist just to resist because things have gotten personal. I mean, not like they have been D.C. with Trump, but how could anybody make things as personal as Trump did? Noam is a much nicer person, personally, than Donald Trump is. And I think our reporters here are less likely to let their personalities get in the way of things. So things go better than they do in D.C., but it has a little D.C., flavor sometimes.
Now, the situation with coronavirus in South Dakota is rapidly changing as expected. Here for an update, we welcome Dr. Kevin Post. He's Chief Medical Officer at Avera Medical Group.
Dr. Post, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. I'm happy to be here.
You know, in the early days of this, when you and other healthcare, professionals and leaders came and talked to us on the show, I just remember we had that sense of, uncertainty that we'd still be talking to each other weeks down the road because we never knew who was going to get sick and who wasn't. And so it's a moment to just say thanks for still being here. We appreciate you're healthy and well and still doing the leadership work that needs to be done.
Thank you. My colleagues and I were just reflecting on that yesterday, how we felt in, 2 months ago when we initially seen the projections and numbers, and then compared to the feeling now when we probably feel more prepared and that we know somewhat more about it, although there's still a lot of unknowns. But
yeah. And I want to remind listeners, because we're talking about clinical trials and research for therapeutics or treatments, we're not necessarily a vaccine right now, but remind people why we don't already have proven treatments for this disease.
Yeah, so, this is why we don't have that. This is a new disease. It is a new virus. Although many things are similar to the common virus, there is just not a specific remedy for this one. So although some of our antiviral medications are showing promise, there are still some limitations to them, and we have to make sure they're safe before we're rolling out. The other thing that sets coronavirus apart is, there's just a general lack of immunity among our community because we haven't seen this before. So our bodies haven't recognized that we don't have our own antibodies. So that really underscores the importance of why we do need to head into research so we can find better treatments available to better protect ourselves, both for this outbreak and what may occur in the unknown future.
All right, let's talk about some of that research and some of those treatments. And I want to start with what's happening, locally and what is showing showing promise. If I asked you what's showing promise, what would you bring up first?
I would first bring up the convalescent plasma therapy. Avera has been very involved with that. It was a study developed by the Food and Drug Administration, it is then driven through Mayo. Avera was one of the early adopters as one of the sites through Mayo for the convalescent plasma therapy. And what that is basically people who have become infected with coronavirus, their body responds by making antibodies. Approximately 4 weeks after you have an active infection, you do have high enough levels of antibodies that we can test to see if you have had a past infection. And those that have had it, we can then have them donate their plasma, which is a portion of their blood that we can then transfuse or give into the selected patients that are suffering from an active coronavirus infection who are quite ill. And hopefully can use another person's antibodies to help stave off or fight that person's infection. So it's been a very beneficial therapy so far at Avera. We've transfused 56 total patients. And usually starting to see improvement within sometimes up to approximately 3 to 5 days. And on average, patients can be discharged 6 days after refusing this, after receiving the therapy.
So let's walk through some of how this works. So when do people donate the plasma? The people who have recovered from COVID-19, how are those selections made? And how much do you get to sort of store up or have in a bank for donations?
Correct. Well, yeah, and the storage is really not the issue. That could be stored easily. But what we need, you know, is, and we're fortunately and unfortunately, we're far enough into this now where we are have had more positives, where people are now about 4 weeks out from their acute illness. And at about 1 month or 4 weeks out is when you can typically can collect from people who are willing to donate their plasma. That plasma is then stored. You know, we go through all the normal testing and treatment safety measures you would, just like you would with a blood transfusion. And then you then administer it into someone with an active infection. So to receive the therapy, if you're going to be the recipient for it, you need to be over 18 years of age for the study. And then we really are focusing on patients who have developed severe symptoms or patients who are very high risk for developing severe symptoms, such as those with severe chronic health conditions, problems with their immune systems, or medications that may suppress their immune system. So we're trying to carefully select which patients we use it on until, of course, we get our stores built up or, so we can treat more this way.
What are we learning about
this? Lori.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say the encouraging thing about this, Lori, is that as we do have more people infected in the area, we will have more donors available as well. So it should be a therapy that hopefully is available while we wait for a vaccine.
Somebody's sitting at home right now and they know they had it, they were tested, it was positive, and they just took care of themselves at home and they recovered. Should they call their doctors and ask if they're a candidate for donating plasma?
Yes, that is the perfect route, is to call your primary care provider. They know your medical history best, your medications best, and that would be the correct route to take, and it would be much appreciated. It's a nice way to give back to others, give back to the community, and so I do encourage the public to do that if they're able and willing.
What are we learning, Dr. Post, about the timing for giving those infusions and what is effective? Because you said, you know, severe symptoms is where the study is focusing on right now. This can, from everything that I've read, this can become pretty severe pretty quickly. So what are we learning about the timing of administering the convalescent plasma therapy?
Right. And as more becomes available, I think we're becoming a little more aggressive on our timing. It's not so much the number of days that you have been ill from, it's more the progression of the illness. So if you start to see over a period of 1 to 2 days where people are, you know, declining rather quickly, that is definitely a time you want to try to proactively get ahead of it and get the transfusion on board. In addition, we are being more proactive with those that have high-risk medical conditions that we're just very concerned in this population or this patient type. You know, they're likely not going to do well with coronavirus, then we may try to get ahead of the curve by transfusing the antibodies. You know, and as if we had an unlimited supply, I think you'd be able to use it more aggressively. But as we get more donors, I think that will become more available. So it's an exciting study. It has shown some benefit. Of course, it's just one tool in the total picture of how you treat a coronavirus infection.
Right. Are people making that decision? Are patients making the decision to be part of the study, or they're choosing between one study and the other? What does it look like for people when they get sick and they're in the hospital as far as making some of those informed choices?
Yeah, and that's a very good point. It is definitely with the engagement with the patients. It should always be a physician and patient decision that's shared together. You know, patients always know they are given the outline of the study, what this is, what are the risks and benefits of receiving this. So it is very transparent, it's open, and people do have the option to participate or not. So, but it, you know, it is one of those situations where I think you look to the physician who's treating you for their recommendation, who knows you best, you know, and knows how your course through the illness is progressing.
Yeah. Are there risks inherent in convalescent plasma therapy?
There are, and it's very similar to receiving a blood transfusion when it comes to risk. You know, so there's always the risk of infectious disease that didn't get caught in the screening process that is very low. Transfusions are all very safe. usually the benefit outweighs the risk, and we always look at that. There can be other things, like you always can have like an allergic response or a true anaphylactic reaction, which is a severe allergic reaction. And then you can have like the normal side effects that when you have a transfusion, such as a low-grade fever, itchiness, things like that. But we can try to give medications, if possible, to pre-medicate to prevent some of them. So there's always risk to everything we do. In this case, this is fairly low risk as long as we follow our normal safety precautions, which we always do.
Yeah. And so how fast is the data coming in as part of this Mayo Clinic study? And we're still talking about convalescent plasma therapy with Dr. Kevin Post from Avera. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. This FDA study through the Mayo Clinic that Avera is participating in, all that data is going back into that study, even as, most people who are listening are concerned about, the health of their loved ones and the immediate results of that. But this is part of this bigger study. How quickly is this process moving forward, as there are so many people across the country who are ill and are part of the study?
Yeah, and it's moving forward fairly quickly. And, fortunately for the Midwest, anyway, we are somewhat behind the curve of the nation. So in other areas like the coast, they've been able to, have many more patients engaged more early just because of the sheer nature that they're ahead of us in this pandemic. That has allowed us to somewhat learn from them as well. But there's, I think it, last I looked, there was like a 1,004 sites who are contributing. So we are collecting a lot of data rather quickly. And our affiliation with Mayo, it's been very responsive, and we are in contact frequently to get updates.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the other studies. And of course, most people in South Dakota have heard about hydroxychloroquine because there is a statewide clinical trial underway. And then we hear about other medications like remdesivir. So let's shift from convalescent plasma therapy and talk about some of the other research efforts. Where would you like to go next? Which one is worth talking about now?
Yeah. I think, Lori, like you said, hydroxychloroquine is heard frequently on the news, and people wonder where we are with that. That has been a nice collaboration between the state, the Immunomine Health, Sanford Health, and Avera to try to bring better therapies for our patients with hydroxychloroquine. And we were just on a call this week, all of us together again. We're looking at it very closely. This is a prevention study with hydroxychloroquine. So it's not for the active infection. But I think what we're watching so closely with hydroxychloroquine is there has been mixed messages out in the media and in research about the effectiveness and side effects of it. So we are very carefully weighing as we develop this study. How do we proceed very carefully for the sake of patient safety? There's a lot of cardiac or heart side effects with this, a lot of interactions with other medications. So if we are going to move forward on this, we need to do so cautiously and never at the risk of our patients.
Yeah. Do we have people participating in it now? And are we looking for new patients? What do some of the numbers look like about this study? Or is the study itself being developed still?
Yeah, the study is still being developed, yes, at this time. So we're trying to, form the inclusion criteria, those that would be excluded. And we're really being cautious because, after a few weeks ago, it came out from the FDA about the study done at the Veterans Administration, the VA, where there was some concerns for hydroxychloroquine. So we're very carefully looking to make sure it's safe to proceed. And if we do, how do we do it in a way that's most safe? I think, again, this underscores the need for good research in general. And I'm happy that our state and our health systems are being involved in that, so we can help hopefully the patients of our area as well as the nation.
Yeah, and I want to go to the very basic level right now for people who are tuning in. This is something that is done through a medical professional, and people were concerned about the politics of this kind of study. And you're telling me that, Monument and Avera in Sanford are working very closely together on the science of this, not influenced by politics at all, that part of the study. Say more a little bit about how researchers sort of, in general, as a standard practice, eliminate, financial pressures or political pressures to make sure that they're focusing on the science and the ethics of that, which are pretty well established in clinical studies.
Right. And I would really like to thank our state of South Dakota as well, because their Department of Health experts and representatives have been phenomenal to work with in this process. And it up front and foremost is always patient safety. The ethics of it, is this the right thing to do, is what we constantly are asking ourselves. So You know, and that is, I think, what we're called on when we do research. And as physicians, you know, first, do no harm to our patients. So we always lay that, you know, if this patient were my family member, if it were me, would I want to be in this study? Would I feel safe being in this study? And those are questions we actively discuss on these calls to make sure we're following the close safety standards and doing what is ethically right and, you know, following our mission.
Let's talk about remdesivir. That's something a lot of people have read about in the national news as well. What is that?
Yeah, remdesivir is an antiviral medication. So like you think of antibiotics such as penicillin to treat bacterial infections, remdesivir is an antivirus. So basically it's a medicine you would take to fight off a viral infection. Often antivirals are maybe not quite as effective as antibiotics, but they can help in some cases prevent and in other cases slow the progression of a disease. Remdesivir, again, has also seen some mixed results in different studies, but overall there is definitely enough of a trend there that there may be some positive value that will continue to explore it. One limitation with remdesivir right now is that the distribution of it nationwide is somewhat limited and conserved and kind of being conserved to certain sites. So we do not have widespread access to it yet at this point. You know, our treatment specialists, our infectious disease doctors are watching this closely. And we're hopeful that if there is ongoing benefit shown, that we can find the best place to use this in our treatment of the coronavirus.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about antibody testing. We're hearing a lot about that as well. And a lot of what we're hearing is the inconsistency of it and, you know, tests that have been rushed to the market without FDA clearance and approval. So first start with, what is antibody testing and how, you know, what is the potential for helping us understand our fight against COVID-19?
Yeah. And antibody testing is a very important topic right now. It's another tool that we can use to help see if people have had the infection or to kind of track how we're doing as a community or a region. So what it is, it's basically a blood test you draw and you get a result back that says if you have had the coronavirus infection in the past. It's kind of a positive or a negative test. It doesn't give you a quantity or a number to it. So it doesn't tell you what level of antibodies you have in your body, just whether you have antibodies to it or not. So there's many things we don't know about this. We don't know if you have antibodies, how well you could fight off another infection, if you're susceptible to another infection or not. It should likely help prevent you from getting another one or not having severe as an illness. But to say that you can go back without any protection, things like that, we don't know yet for sure. Where it is very valuable is you can use it to monitor, like, you know, whatever we're pushing patient safety. We're making it safe for our patients to come back in. So we're wearing our personal protective equipment. We have all of our safety measures. You can use it to measure how well you're doing compared to the general public. That's a tool for it. It can be, we're looking at using it. Can it be a tool for our employees for returning to work, situations like that? But I do think, like you brought up, Lori, we have to remember there are limitations to what the test tells us and how we can best use it. So, you know, I think all of us healthcare professionals are looking at how we best use this both in our own health systems, our communities, and nationwide as we try to, return to the new normal and live with COVID.
Yeah. Is it being deployed in healthcare scenarios yet across the nation or in South Dakota where healthcare workers and emergency room doctors and nurses, for example, are using the test yet? Is there a study going on? What's it look like right now?
Yeah, right now, I think health systems are just starting to use the test and figuring how to best use it. So, you know, what a health system might do is use a small pilot group, a test group, one maybe, say, for instance, one department to try to track what the numbers look like, what we would do with those numbers if we rolled it out system-wide, and how we can best use it to help us without adding to any confusion. And especially what you don't want to do is give people a false sense of security. So say I myself tested positive that I had the condition. What you don't want is that I now feel secure going out in public, not practicing the normal typical safety measures that are so important as well. So,
yeah, what I'm wondering specifically is if people are having those tests, are we collecting data from that to help us understand,
yeah,
you know, more about that antibody test? Yeah.
I specifically don't know. They are collecting the data. I specifically don't know of any studies going on right now. I would suspect there are. I just do not know any of them personally or any in our area. I suspect as that rolls, since the antibody testing is a little bit of a later phase, I think as we get through this first acute rush of the coronavirus, I think we'll start seeing a lot heavier focus on antibody testing and how it is best used. So yeah. It's almost kind of a phase two of this pandemic. You know, we're now moving into this type of testing and how we can best implement it.
And we're also moving into this time when we have more tests available. We especially see with Smithfield workers some larger scale testing. Governor Kristi Noem has said repeatedly, you know, watch the hospital, the numbers of active hospitalizations. That number right now is up to 76 active hospitalizations throughout the state, up from 70 yesterday. Tell us a little bit, Dr. Post, about getting ready for the surge, because this is all part of the same conversation that we've been having for weeks now, that it's very, very important not to overrun any individual hospital or community hospital. When we talk about research and clinical studies and the antivirals and the convalescent plasma therapy, how does it tie all in to this notion of surge preparation for our hospitals?
Yeah, and when it comes to surge preparation, I just want to take a moment here and really thank our listeners and the public for everything they did with our mitigation efforts for staying at home. I mean, in our area, we have seen a nice flattening of the curve, and a lot of that is due to the cooperation of all of us here in the Midwest, and so thank you for that. And what that has done, it has allowed us to slow the number of cases so we don't overwhelm our healthcare system, you know, and that includes things such as having enough protective equipment for our patients and our employees. It means it looks like we may have enough hospital beds, ICU beds, ventilators, and other equipment that's necessary. The other thing that has been very beneficial here in the U.S. is we have been able to decrease the length of the hospital stay, so we can then turn patients over as well, more quickly as well, so you don't get quite the backlog of patients we were first expecting. So if I look back, like we talked about earlier in the show, if I look back to 2 months ago, I'm much more optimistic that our health systems in our region will be able to handle the load of the patients. However, that will hinge upon how well we do as a public, just being wise and responsible. You know, I think our governor has given us a lot of liberty, but we have to handle that liberty with responsibility. And thankfully, we haven't had to go down in lockdown. And I think if we continue to be responsible and to do our part, we can come through this okay. I think if we get reckless and kind of careless where we aren't watching ourselves, then we may see a rebound in the surge. And you know, due to the economic reasons, we really don't want to go back into any mitigation efforts as well, because the economic impact of that is also staggering.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit, because when we talk about ventilators and we talk about the, you know, 31 deaths in South Dakota and 76, the hospital, you know, 76 active hospitalizations right now, when you go into the hospital, and what I'm getting at here, Dr. Post, is encouraging people to be proactive with their symptoms, because we are hearing about people who are really dealing with that fear of, like, I don't want to be intubated. I don't want to go into the hospital. This is a scary place to be. A lot of this treatment is not getting to the ventilator stage, right? Tell us a little bit, and just, we have about a minute left, of how people should be proactive about their symptoms and about getting the treatment that they need, even if that is calling your doctor and saying, I think I need to go to the hospital.
Yes, and you're exactly right. If you do have health conditions, we are ready to see people again. We have the equipment ready. I urge you not to wait, because, you know, the uncontrolled diabetes, heart symptoms, those cannot wait, because we are seeing the fallouts of people not coming in when they're having heart attacks, strokes, and letting conditions go. We are now ready to see people. We have the equipment ready. We have measures in place to keep you safe when you come in. So the risk of staying home is actually going to be much worse than coming in. I understand how the perception may have gotten there through this, but we are prepared and to see you safely.
All right, Dr. Kevin Post, thank you so much for being here. We will continue to wash our hands and keep distant from each other and use those really smart things in hopes to keep everyone safe. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Lori.
This Wednesday, as they do every Wednesday, the Dakota Political Junkies join Lori Walsh to talk the state's top political headlines. Enjoy.
Professor Card, welcome back.
Thank you, Lori. It's wonderful to be here.
We also have with us Jonathan Ellis with the Argus Leader. Jonathan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Hi, Michael.
Let's talk a little bit about the state budget, because as we look at the response for the governor, clearly there are a lot of different ways to evaluate that response, and one is from a public health standpoint and one is from an economic standpoint. We're seeing some of those early numbers come in, and Mike Card, you've had a chance to look at them probably more carefully than I have, and I'm wondering what are some of the things that we're seeing, because it's not a complete picture yet. It's an early picture, but it's an interesting one for sure.
It is. You know, South Dakota has a budget of over $5 billion. 1.7 of that is what we call a general fund that is sort of like our main family checking account, if you will. There's some danger in making that analogy, but I think that's one that makes sense to most of us, is it's the one that we pay the day-to-day operations out of. We pay our mortgage bills, we buy our groceries, and things of that nature. And what we're seeing from the March figures, March to March 2019 to 2020, there really wasn't much of a change. What we are seeing from April of 2019 to 2020, and even in terms of the legislature and the governor's office's Bureau of Finance and Management, is we're down about $18 million from that. So we're expecting a decline in the general fund of 20% to 30%, at least that's what the experts are saying. So what that means for South Dakota is if 50% of our dollars go to fund education and to fund people who can't take care of themselves and to incarcerate people to protect them from themselves and us from them, that's really where we're seeing this decline of in the neighborhood of $500 million if the 30% decline holds forward.
Jonathan, as you look at these numbers, and Governor Noem's, you know, pointed out in her last press briefing or a couple days ago, I'm kind of lost track of time, but the timing of this is interesting. We haven't seen the full impact of these because some of the sales tax receipts are up in certain areas, food stores, for example, and building materials and hardware stores. People are doing home improvements and things like that, even though they're staying home. Hotels, clothing, restaurants, terrible numbers there for that. What are you seeing when you look at the numbers, and what do you sort of expect the story in the days ahead to be?
Well, I mean, some of it's not a surprise, obviously, in the sectors that you mentioned. I mean, restaurants are basically shut down. I'm hopeful that we can kind of maybe turn a corner here at some point. There's no doubt that this is going to have an effect on revenues, both state and local governments here for sure. But anecdotally, I do see just a lot of economic activity still out there. I mean, it's not like everything is, it's a ghost town out there. I go out and do some reporting, and there are a lot of people out and about doing stuff. I think it could be, a lot worse, and it could be a lot worse. So I think as this plays out, I mean, this is a snapshot in time, and we're going to have to see as everything evolves in this whole thing, how that plays out.
And so much of this, Jonathan, can't be controlled in the sense that, there has been much focus about what the governor or the mayor or the president has mandated. But truthfully, if you're at a smaller town in South Dakota, for example, and you really haven't had community spread yet, you've had a couple of cases, and all of a sudden you do, that's going to change how people feel about going out and about, and people are going to start making some of those decisions that can be catastrophic to public health or great public health decisions or catastrophic to the economy. It's not all about the mandate and the policy, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think that, a coworker I was talking to today was saying he was out in the country at the gas station getting coffee, and bunch of farmers were sitting around, and I think there was about a dozen of them, he said, and they were definitely not social distancing. And so as you know, at some point when you get out into those communities that haven't seen this and it starts to, you get one or two people who get it, I think then it has a bigger consequence. So again, I mean, a lot of this making conclusions about, you know, the disease itself, the virus itself, how we're responding to it, the economics of it. I mean, all of this is just, everything is so fluid right now that we're making a lot of interesting conclusions on something that is, you know, in 2 months might be totally different. So yeah, I just, it's snapshots in time, you know?
Right. But Dr. Card, education, it seems not a stretch to say that the education budget in a state where that has been such a challenge in the past, and teachers' pay has been such a challenge, university services, it's, you know, incredibly hard on colleges, just deciding whether to send students home or not, to send refunds or not. Colleges are spending more money on online platforms and are losing money. There's tough days ahead, aren't there?
Well, I think there are tough days ahead, but in South Dakota, we're kind of used to that. We have a belief that we should have the lowest level of government possible, and I think Governor Noem captures the political culture appropriately in terms of individual responsibility. And in some senses, that's a wonderful thing, and in some senses, that can be a terrible thing if we overwhelm our resources. In South Dakota, we really have three worlds. We have a Sioux Falls, Rapid City, metropolitan world. We have a small town world, and we have an extremely rural world. And we haven't had that real Rock Hudson moment yet. That is, referring back to the AIDS crisis, when we recognized if Rock Hudson can get AIDS, then maybe I can too. Now, there's lots of dissimilarities between acquired immune deficiency syndrome or AIDS and the coronavirus or COVID-19. But I think to some extent, people change their behavior when they learn of people who do get COVID-19, and especially when someone they know has to be hospitalized or someone passes away. It's a real challenge that we have in this state because these are such different worlds and we only live in one generally.
Yeah, I think that's so smart. And I realize that because of what I do here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. But sometimes even I get caught up in that. And it was not, I suppose, last summer, last fall, where I went somewhere and literally everyone who heard I was from Sioux Falls asked me about the crime rate and asked me if I was scared to live in Sioux Falls. And Jonathan, I had to come back home and search the Argus Leader. I'm like, do we have a crime rate problem that I'm not aware of? Because that was not my perception of living in Sioux Falls at all. And I think I got asked like 11 times, anybody who said, where do you live? And I said, I live in Sioux Falls. Stabbings and murders, and they had a real impression that was drastically different from my impression from just going to work and living my life every day. So Mike's right. The idea of this being a Sioux Falls story right now, or a Minnehaha County story, can make a difference in the days ahead with how people behave and how that changes if there are different hotspots or clusters throughout the state.
Oh, well, definitely. And I think that observation that Mike made, that's why you pay him the big bucks, because that was that was a good observation.
Yeah.
You know, I will say, you know, that in Huron, which was sort of the ground zero when this all started, you know, Mike's right on. I mean, a couple people got it and there were a couple fatalities there, unfortunately. And but I think that changed the behavior in Huron changed very quickly. And they have not had, I have not had a new case now here, or Beetle County has not had a new case. I should make sure I look at today's data, but I don't think they've had a case in probably about a month. I mean, so the behavior changed quickly there.
Right. I want to close and make sure we talk about this South Dakota Supreme Court ruling that has to do with forced catheterization. Oh, thanks, Jonathan. Say it for me, because my brain is tired today, apparently.
You're doing it just fine.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Tell us what's changed in that story, because this is an ongoing saga.
Yeah, this is it was actually a federal court ruling by Roberto Lang, who the chief judge right now in the federal district court system, who for trivia purposes, is the son of longtime state lawmaker Gerald Ng from Lake County, Madison. So just a little trivia there. But anyway, it was a ruling that the forced catheterization practice that law enforcement uses to extract urine involuntarily for people who run afoul of the law for some reason was unconstitutional. And it was really, I call it, the opinion was really kind of a Christmas tree of quotes. I very clearly Ng did not like this practice, and that was there were many quotes to choose to pull from it. It'll be interesting to see. I didn't get a response if anybody plans to appeal this to the Eighth Circuit, or there will be a trial. This is something that will probably be appealed. And in Ng's ruling, he noted that there were two cases where people weren't even necessarily confronted by law enforcement because of something, because of they were suspected of drug use or anything. In two cases of the six he heard, one of them was just on a bench warrant. They decided to catheterize this guy to see if they could get him for having drugs, because again, South Dakota is one of the few places, one of the only states, if not the only state, in which you can get a drug charge if they detect it in your urine. So it's a practice that has been highly controversial. My former colleague, who's now at the New York Times, Mark Walker, did a great investigative series on that a few years ago.
Mike Cards, the story in the Argus Leader at argusleader.com that Jonathan Ellison wrote about this, and then there's a link to the Mark Walker piece with the details of this. It does seem pretty gratuitous, but I guess that's an opinion as well. Help me out as we close segment.
Judge Ng laid out in 106 pages recounting the particulars of each particular catheterization, and included videos taken by law enforcement that showed three of the plaintiffs screaming in agony. I think this violates what most of us would consider to be appropriate behavior by law enforcement, and having witnesses watch this as medical personnel were directed to catheterize people. And, our U.S. Constitution is basically set up around freedom from government, especially with the Bill of Rights, the first 10 Amendment, of which this is the 8th Amendment, prohibiting it's always good to lose your train of thought right in the middle on the radio. Fourth Amendment.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.